Welcome to Accessibility Ally. It's a podcast featuring guests with a range of disabilities and social identities. They share provocative ideas and challenge allies to disrupt ableism. And I'm your host, Corey Melanson. Thanks for tuning in. So in today's episode, we talk with Ursula and Aaron, and we have a conversation about one example of neurodiversity, formal diagnosis versus self-diagnosis, and even what some of the barriers are to diagnosis. What are some of the advantages of being a neurodivergent person in the workplace? So when our brains are wired differently, what does that mean in terms of our creativity, our ability to collaborate, for example? And we really tackle the question, what do accommodations for neurodiversity in the workplace look and feel like? Ursula, let's start with you. Do you want to introduce yourself, including any social identities you're comfortable sharing?
Yeah, sure. My name's Ursula. My pronouns are they, them. Identify as queer, gender fluid, neurodivergent, fat. I'm a knitter. I'm a librarian. I'm large. I contain multitudes.
I love that you included, yeah, you're a knitter and all of those things in there.
And the knitting looks amazing, by the way.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Like, will you be knitting as we're chatting?
Possibly. Yeah.
Okay. So what are you knitting? Describe it for us.
I am knitting a pair of rainbow socks, basically.
Okay.
From the toe up.
Okay. Really great.
Yeah.
Aaron, why don't you introduce yourself?
So my name is Erin Casey. I am a middle-aged woman, and Corey and I work together quite a bit, and I have a real passion for accessibility. I'm the parent of two young adults who are autistic and have other invisible disabilities as well. So I'm really excited to be here today and talk about this.
Yeah. So fairly recently, it was released in Nova Scotia that the numbers of people with disabilities are now in Nova Scotia are now 2 in 5. And so we in Nova Scotia, it's like the highest rate of people with disabilities across the country. And I think that mostly when we think about disabilities, we think about visible disabilities, right? So folks with mobility devices, whether that's, you know, a cane or a wheelchair, or I don't know, what else comes to mind when you think about visible disabilities?
Oh, well, people who wear hearing aids, other things like that. Anything, yeah. There's lots of different assistive devices that people use or assistive technologies.
Yeah.
I also think about, and you mentioned hearing aids, Ursula, which is an interesting one because my son wears hearing aids and they're visible but not, right? I mean, you actually have to like really be peering at him to see them. And and I would say too, in my experience, you know, some disabilities become more visible as you spend time with a person. So a disability that might be invisible at first will become more visible over a period of time.
Yeah. And then there's this big category of like invisible disabilities. And, you know, we know that includes so many things like chronic illness, anything that falls in sort of the neurodivergent category, and which we'll be talking about. Also things like, you know, I just interviewed recently someone who is deaf. And so until you engage with that person, that's really invisible. But also things like mental health issues. Just from past work I've done, even in kind of post-secondary education in Nova Scotia, what I heard from folks working in accessibility is that 80% or more of the students that they were supporting with, you know, around accessibility issues, it was because of mental health issues. So this probably is the invisible disabilities is really that larger category. Ursula, you talked about identifying as neurodivergent, and tell us more about how you identify.
Sure. Well, I've known most of my life that I was highly intelligent. That was apparent when I was a kid in school and with the Canadian Basic Skills Testing. And I knew also that I didn't really think like anybody else around me. that's been my entire life. It's been a struggle of trying to figure out where I fit in or if I fit in, and figuring out why I struggle to do things that quote unquote normal people like or everybody around me seems to be able to just do or know about. Like I didn't get the rule book for the game of life in many ways. So that's been my experience. And it was a very much an internalized experience for like the first 48 years of my life because I had no idea. I didn't really relate to any of the articles about things like ADHD because I had developed really robust frameworks for my life so that I could fulfill all of the things that I was supposed to be doing, like, you know, getting assignments in on time, meeting deadlines. I had strategies and I had tools in place. So I felt like that's not me. And then the pandemic happened and all of that structure fell apart and everything just got really, really hard.
I'm curious, you talk about these robust frameworks that you developed.
Mm-hmm.
How much energy does it take for you to create and maintain those frameworks?
Exactly. I was exhausted a lot. living, honestly, well, I got some of them from my mom. One of them being, if I'm not 10 minutes early, I'm late. And it also made me kind of a prickly person because I felt like I went to such a great deal of effort to be somewhere on time that when other people were late, it felt like they didn't care about me or they didn't care about my time. And yeah, so my friends in my 20s got very used to like being very punctual with me. So yeah, it's exhausting. It can be alienating unintentionally. Yeah, it was a struggle looking back at it.
So what happened when, so the pandemic hit, no structure, and by that do you mean in work and like your personal life? Like what did that look like or what did that feel like?
Yeah, well, one of the things I've developed like that I think is actually really healthy is I have really firm work-life boundaries. I worked for a lot of small businesses locally, and that's the owner's passion, and they will spend every waking minute of their day doing that, and they profit from it. And then they expect everybody else to be as invested, except I'm not seeing those profits. So, and I have to work another part-time job on the side. So no, I'm not staying past five. So home is where I don't work, right? And that's very set in my brain. I can't even, if I'm not scheduled to work from home now, and I have work that I feel I should do at home, I can't do it. My brain literally just doesn't let me do it because it established that pattern early on. So I didn't have that. I didn't have the going out of the house and going to work. And I tried to maintain like a fairly consistent 9 to 5, but nobody else in my organization really did and kept trying to call me at 6 and 7 and just kind of expecting me to be available. And I was unfortunately working like two very different positions because I hadn't fully transitioned. So I had both like a physical location to take care of and staff and things to manage around that while I was shifting into a broader, more regional programming based role. And wow, that was a lot. It was a lot. And without some of those structures, I lived alone. It was really rough. So I started therapy because I finally had the time to do it in summer 2020, and I knew I really needed to. So by the time 2022 rolled around, I had been in therapy for about a year and a half. I was progressing and feeling really good about my mental health at that point. I'd figured out some things to do with my physical health that were also contributing to things like fatigue and brain fog and gotten that sorted. So when I came back from work after like a 3-week Christmas vacation, and I don't celebrate Christmas, so it's really chill for me. Those 3 weeks are great. And everything was still just as hard and awful as it was before. I was like, well, I'm feeling better physically. My mental health is on track. I'm not stupid. So what's going on? Mm-hmm. And then I think I did read an article that did finally resonate. And I was like, yeah, I think this might be it. And so I went to see my doctor. And we did one of the little quickie diagnostic tests, and it was enough for her to say, yeah, no, I'm going to refer you. I did not want to go through the public system because A, I had no time to do that. I was desperate. I needed something much sooner than that could happen. And I luckily had a little bit of savings and investments because despite being terrible with money, a smart decision is to get a financial advisor who takes your money away from you and does smart things with it.
Right.
So I had a little bit of a cushion that I could use. And so I went through a process of figuring out who might be a good fit. I was looking in particular for somebody who was queer or queer friendly, because that's important to me for my dollars to be going back into my community. But also in like a diagnostic sense, I don't want to have to explain my entire life,
mm-hmm.
right? So going to somebody with some knowledge in that area or experience in that area is ideal for me. And so I found Dr. Barker at Crux Psychology and booked in an appointment in February 2022, and in March went back for my results, and yeah, ADHD combined type. And also he noted at the end of the report that he recommended further testing for autism spectrum disorder, and also reconfirmed that, yeah, gifted. So he called it twice blessed, I guess, but if you add, you know, autism in there as well, I call it now a triple threat. And I don't have a formal diagnosis there, but now that I am medicated for ADHD, wow, all of the sensory and social kind of things that the ADHD was somehow masking really, really became apparent. And so I've just decided to accommodate myself as if I have autism. I can't afford to do another assessment right now. And honestly, I don't see a lot of value in it right now. It could actually be more harm than value to have a formal diagnosis there. And there's not really any support for adults with autism. Not anything really robust. So
can you talk a little bit about the self-diagnosis piece, Ursula?
Sure. I mean, I do feel comfortable with self-diagnosis because I don't think that the everyday person kind of, I don't hate the word normal, but sometimes that's the best, I don't know. Anyway, I don't mean it as like normal is what everybody should be, but as the, you know, not what I am right now.
Neurotypical.
Exactly.
That's
neurotypical.
Kind of a
yeah.
term that sometimes
yeah.
people use.
Yeah.
But I
so
actually
average,
think that might go away at some point
maybe,
in the future
yeah.
because, you know, are is anyone neurotypical?
I don't
That's
think so.
I
think everybody's
know.
Neurotypes are different. I think
yeah.
some just fall in a broad band.
Yes, exactly.
And some follow in a narrower band.
Yeah. I like that. Broad band, narrow band.
Exactly. yeah. Exactly.
Along a continuum.
Yeah.
I have this whole thinking about neurodiversity that is that it's certainly within the normal range of human development and experience. And I think 10, 15, 20 years from now, being neurodivergent is going to be a bit like being left-handed.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd love to see that, actually.
Yeah.
In terms of self-diagnosis, yeah. I think, I'm pretty comfortable with that because I don't think neurotypical people wonder all the time why they can't do things or wonder why they don't like to wear a certain brand of socks or always have to wear the same shirt and pants style. Or like, I don't think neurotypical people wonder if they have autism for the most part, right? And then, and some of the reading I've been doing recently, I think there was a study that showed that a really high percentage of people who, you know, use the same test that I'd taken and self-diagnosed, they were right?
Okay.
They were correct. And also, frankly, I don't see any harm in accommodating myself this way.
So you got this diagnosis and you are on medication. You've said that's made a big difference.
Yep.
What were some of the barriers that you faced at work, like before the diagnosis or even, I mean, sort of before and maybe even ones that continue?
Yeah. Oh, well, the big one is I do really struggle to maintain a longer term project. I'm really good at the the generative kind of like phase. Really great at like brainstorming. Love that bit. I am your ideas guy. Then the middle part is really mushy. I don't know how to figure out how to get from the start to the end. I don't know what that looks like. And so I don't know how to do things like that until I'm actually just doing them, which makes it really hard to delegate because I don't know what needs to be done. And therefore, I don't know what I need to delegate and what I can't handle. And yeah, it becomes really overwhelming. And then when it becomes too overwhelming, it just progress halts entirely. And I go into an avoidant mode. So yeah, that is something that I think is a longstanding like pattern that I'm working on breaking or reframing or reshaping. And I use, I rely, for instance, on my manager to like have regular like weekly check-ins. And to provide me with like firm deadlines and checkpoints and milestones so that I have like something to strive for. If I've got something large, I reach out to her to help me like chunk it out, like break it down a little bit so that my brain will find it more manageable.
And was your manager open to that?
Like, yeah, it was a really different way for her to work. And I think like we had really long meetings every 2 weeks. And the other thing that I realized that I did in those meetings was that sometimes I just need to talk about a problem and I can talk my way to the solution, but I need to have another human there to do that. So yeah, the verbal processing is really, really useful for me. And which makes me really good at things like collaborative work and communication. So
yeah, Erin is pointing at me because as I've been learning more about ADHD, I'm just like, oh yeah, right. I'm pretty sure if I did a diagnosis, everything you're describing is me.
Yeah, Corey and I were smiling at each other as you were describing some of the like beginning a project. And I can relate to that too. Mm-hmm. Like Corey and I can go great guns at the very beginning, but we do get stuck in the mushy middle sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that's very relatable. And the idea of talking to think, I call it.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Extremely useful and very relatable as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Staff I've supervised have struggled with that until they've gotten to know me a little bit because I don't know why people, also neurotypical people, don't believe me when I tell them things that they need to know about me. And one of them that I tell everybody is, thinking out loud actually means what it says for me. So if we're in a meeting and I'm throwing out ideas, you don't have to look terrified because it came out of my mouth and therefore you have to do it. I want you to challenge me. I want you to tell me why it's a bad idea or what parts of it you think might work and the ones that won't, right? Mm. So once people get used to that, we have some pretty lively meetings and it can be really fun.
Yeah. But I was going to say that. I think it is really fun.
Yeah.
Have your colleagues come to appreciate this?
Yeah, in some ways. They've seen sometimes how work can be accomplished much more quickly if you just spend that time to like talk through it with each other. A simple solution sometimes, you know, comes out of a discussion or a chance meeting, you know, pop into somebody's office. So.
And I wonder how many people like during the pandemic were like, oh, here I am in my house alone. And now I'm not getting to have those meetings or to do those things in the way that I would do them. And then all of a sudden they're like, whoa, what's going on? What's happening here? I'm kind of curious. I have no idea if there's any research out there on this at all, but kind of an interesting
I can thing. Imagine that research is happening about this
now. Yeah, probably.
But so much of what we think of as creativity and problem solving is really the serendipity of what you're describing too.
Yep.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. No. And that is one of the things I do enjoy about like in like being back in office and working in person. It was really important for the work that I was doing mm-hmm. to be accessible in that way to the staff who were serving the public every day. Mm-hmm. It felt too removed to when I wasn't on site and, you know.
So what kinds of like accommodations support you at work? So you talked about having a manager who you meet with more frequently and some additional support in terms of breaking down sort of project tasks. Are there other things that work well or really help to support being neurodivergent?
Yeah, I mean, there's some physical setup that works really well. My previous role, I was a manager, so I had an office with a door that I could close and I would put a curtain on the window so I could, and I had a white noise machine, which I don't like white noise, brown noise is better. I also, because again, if it's out of my sight, it's out of my mind. I don't file things until they are done. Like I don't have to look at them anymore. So doing that in a virtual environment, I usually like a dual monitor setup is a necessity because I need to spread things out so I can see them. And the way that I work, I also I task switch fairly frequently to according to priority or to interest or whatever needs to get done. Sometimes during the course of a day, I'll do micro breaks. Sometimes that looks like doing work for a volunteer gig instead of my work, but I need a quick win, something I can start and finish within 5 or 10 minutes to sustain my interest in some of the longer or more, you know, boring work that I have to do. Mm-hmm.
So tell us the truth about how many tabs you have open.
So on my phone, I think I'm currently under 100, but I did find out last year that if you go over 100 on an Android phone in Chrome, it goes over 99, all it does is give you a smiley face. It doesn't actually tell you how many tabs you have anymore.
Have you learned this personally?
Yep. Oh, yeah. Oh, no, I've seen it. Yeah. It's tried to put it in separate windows even and be like, here, start a new window. I was like, okay. No, one window, many tabs. However, at work currently, I'm in a Microsoft 365 environment and I was like, okay, fine. I'll use all the integrated tools. I'll use Edge. And there's some features on Edge that I'm really enjoying, including the collaborative kind of workspaces in the browser, which when you close them, you can reopen them and all your tabs and everything that you were in the middle of is still there. So I have like Edge browser collections basically for several research projects I'm working on. I have one just for general work and then I have a personal one. And so I've got about a half dozen of those. And so I can contain all of those tabs, okay. But literally in those six, there's probably probably close to 100 open tabs in there. Yeah, or more. It just depends on what's going on. Because again, I open a tab and I leave it open until I'm done what I needed to do with it, and then I close it. So
what about, so you've talked about working from home, mm-hmm. and working in the office, and what about like just that kind of flexibility? Is that something that helps?
It does, absolutely. I got pretty burnt out last year, and I started a new job in the middle of summer, which has been really great, but still, I have been taking advantage of the 2 out of 5 days to work from home because I realized that as much as I do prefer working in an office with people, I do need a couple of days a week where I can take a huge chunk of decision making out of my day. And working from home allows me to indulge myself the night before and stay up a little later, which always feels like a treat. And I get to sleep in a little later. I get to have a more leisurely, you know, cup of tea out of an actual mug instead of a Contigo when I'm, you know, checking my email. And I don't have to make decisions about, you know, figuring out what to bring to eat during the day. I don't have to figure out the best route using my GPS in the mornings to get there. Like there's so many micro decisions that happen just to get me to and from work that having a couple of days a week just to eliminate all of those has been kind of a nice kind of rest.
Can you talk a little bit about why relieving all that decision making is important? I understand,
yep.
But I don't know if everyone would.
Oh, yeah. The key there is that I am making decisions all the time. None of that is able to become habit for me. I have to think about everything. Basically, the minute I get up, I start thinking about the next thing that I have to do. None of that really happens on autopilot unless I've really, really trained my physical memory, which I have a really good physical memory, but I don't know if it's innate or it's because I've trained it. people with ADHD, I don't know if either struggle or lack the capacity to really develop habits. And that, again, made a lot of sense to me in reflection because, I'd do something and I'd feel like it was really reasonable. Like I would do 10 to 15 minutes of yoga every morning before work and I would be able to sustain that for 3 months until, bam, springtime change happens. And suddenly, my day rhythm is circadian rhythm is all thrown off and I miss a day and then I never do it again. But most people would be able to miss a day and then get back to it. I miss a day and my brain goes, oh, we're done with that. And it's more of a struggle to fight that than anything else I've found.
Yeah, I think a lot of neurotypical people probably would listen to what you're saying and say, well, do you have to think about every decision? And yes, indeed you do, right?
I do.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah.
So thank you for explaining that.
Oh, you're welcome.
What advice do you have for workplaces or businesses around understanding what someone needs who is neurodivergent?
Understanding that just because you've done it a couple of times, it doesn't mean you get to stop. Right. So if I tell somebody I need really direct communication and very clear, and I also need a lot of context to help me understand, I get that for the first couple of times. And then they think, most of the time they're like, oh, well, they've done that a few times now. So they must be able to, right? And neurotypical person would, except I'm not neurotypical and I still need that. It's consistent. Yeah. And the other piece is be open to having to try different things because especially when somebody is first figuring it out, I'm about 2 years in and I'm still figuring out things and I probably will for the rest of my life. Understand that you don't do one thing and it works and it's the magic fix and then you don't have to try anything else. I think that's really important to understand and it's important because sometimes, especially if you change workplaces, sometimes the tools that you used in one workplace won't even work in the next workplace because, again, it's a different work culture, could be different role entirely. So, that is really great. But I think also workplaces need to understand that if they can accommodate effectively, they're going to get an employee who is, creative. Who, because of the way their brain works, maybe doesn't see, fine detail, but they can see the big picture. Like they've got that 30,000 foot kind of scope already. And, in terms of pattern recognition, that pulled back kind of view allows them to see that. So that there's a capacity for that I think, is really important for them to understand too. Like if they can, be flexible and patient and accommodate effectively, they're going to have somebody really valuable on their team.
So how does the invisibility of your disability affect you at work?
When I first meet people or join a new team or work on a committee, it's because it's invisible. I have to make a decision about disclosing or not. And depending on circumstances, that is more or less comfortable. Then I might need accommodations for the work that we are doing. So, it's a little bit of a tightrope to walk. But I don't know. It's a that's a
The disclosure conversation is maybe a whole other conversation,
yeah,
right?
That's a whole other conversation, mm-hmm. for sure.
Yeah, how do workplaces create sort of more safer environments, safer processes for people to disclose?
Ugh.
And even I had a conversation with someone this week who has a very visible disability, but also because during COVID of working online and continuing virtual work, they still have to disclose, even though, so they've never had to before. They use a wheelchair. Hmm. They, you know.
I had never thought about that.
Yeah. Neither had I before this before the conversation. I thought, wow, okay, that also really shifted the dynamic around disclosure.
Mm.
So what gives you hope for a more accessible future in our workplaces, in our communities?
I think the thing that's giving me the most hope, honestly, it has come out of the pandemic, is the flexibility to work from home. We realized that we can do it and that the people who are asking for that for years knew what they were talking about. And broadly, it feels like things that are being put in place to accommodate people who are neurodivergent, I think that other people are realizing, oh, I think I would like that as well. And I think that works better for me than this other framework I've been using. So I think everybody would like to work in an office where they didn't have glaring, harsh overhead fluorescent lights, but could control the lighting in their own little cubicle, yeah, or office, right? They would, you know, like to be able to have the sound level, like the sound level and distraction level that, you know, best suits them. They might prefer to have a sit-stand desk as well so that they can move around more during the day.
And can we also just say that knitting should be definitely allowed at like all meetings and in all workspaces?
Exactly.
And maybe Play-Doh too.
Yeah. Oh,
and
yeah.
As a perennial doodler myself, yep, and creating works of art during meetings,
yep,
like I spent a lot of my life with people thinking I wasn't paying attention,
yep,
or that I wasn't listening or I wasn't, yep, engaged, and yep, which of course we know is not
the
case. Oh,
yeah. No, right? I was, doodled everything. On everything. I had the same experience.
What advantages and strengths do you bring to the table in the workplace?
Ooh. I've got a lot. I think because of my neurodivergent brain, I've had a really unconventional career, like life path, basically. I have done a lot of weird jobs and cool things. And I bring a lot of life experience with me to anything, which was incredibly like worthwhile. While I was working as a librarian in the public library, one minute I could be talking about like air compressors and what people were like, what somebody was looking for to compare. Because I had experience doing like working with those, and then I'd be off showing somebody like where the craft books are and advising them on like the best authors for whatever project that they were working on, and then I'd be, you know, doing some reader's advisory or finding somebody, you know, the next TV series to watch. So basically, bring a lot of life experience with me. That can be transferable or applicable to pretty much anything else that I do. I learn really quickly on the job. And again, I think that because I see the pattern recognition is really good. I can walk into a new role, kind of learn and be in it for a month or two, and then be able to say, okay, but what if we did it this way instead, and then it would eliminate this step? Like I find ways to improve or make things more efficient. I've used that skill, like working like piecework and factory lines. I was good at figuring out where the bottlenecks were, and figuring out how to adjust for them. I knew how I could judge how fast people could work, and I'd like say, hey, why don't you come over here? So there's that. And I'm also really creative. Ideas guy. I love to say yes. I also think I'm a great manager because I don't want to be micromanaged and I don't micromanage. And I think it's also, well, partly due to the fact that, well, I don't know the details of your job. I can barely hold on to the details of mine half the time. And you're competent and you can do that. And I'm going to trust you to do that. And I'll be here to talk about whatever you need to problem solve.
And people respond really well to that.
They do.
Kind of management, typically.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, if I'm managing new staff, I'm assuming that the people who hired them previously hired them for very good reasons. And as I get to know them, I usually find out that's true. I'm rarely proven wrong. So
I like that idea of you're presuming competence.
Yep. But absolutely.
I'm sure that in part comes from your own experiences.
Yep.
That, you know, you need people to presume your competence and put, you know, have faith in your abilities and support you. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. I've had to prove myself competent in many areas, but I really quickly do. And it has made me more compassionate, I think. So I'm a very empathetic colleague or supervisor. I don't want anybody else ever feeling like the ways that I have felt. So I do my best to set everybody up around me to be their best.
If people listening could take one idea away with them today, what would you want that idea to be? You can have two if you want.
Only one.
I never get it. Only one idea.
Well, you can have two or three. Yeah. Do whatever you want.
The one idea I would love for folks to take away is that productivity is not the be-all and end-all, and there's different ways to approach the way you work.
Yay! Oh, I love that. I love that you said that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Productivity in terms of living with an invisible disability, I find it can be a really harmful concept. I think our value as human beings is to be the best human beings that we can be and have the best human experience while we are here. Do I think going to an office like 9 to 5, 5 days a week is like the best use of my talents?
Creative talents?
I don't. The world is missing out on a lot of stuff just because I have to do this to survive. Mm. I think it's really important for everyone to understand that productivity isn't your value. You have a lot of other things that you bring to the table that I think are far superior. Like, are you a really amazing friend who would, you know, drop everything you've got, you know, to go and help? Can you organize like the best, most fun potluck? Can you write an amazing story that will move me? Can you make a piece of art? Can you grow the best tomatoes?
Can you love and be loved in return?
Exactly. And that is huge. And I think so many people struggle with just that. All of the corporate kind of training that I've had around accommodation and disability in the workplace, and even just this week, the reasons for accommodation are only seem tangentially related to the human being they're supposed to be accommodating. They're really the real pitch is productivity, which I think is bizarre.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I hadn't really thought very much about that, but I think you're right that often accommodations in the workplace or in school are more aimed at, like, how can we make this person be more productive and be able to keep pace with their peers?
Streamlining the experience. So
Yeah.
It's not really about how can we support this person to having the best, most fulfilling experience they can have, whatever that looks like for them.
Yeah, exactly.
What gives you hope for an accessible future?
This is maybe not something that makes me hopeful for the future, but something that I hope for the future instead. Again, reflecting on my life and the struggles that I've had and, you know, where I'm at and where I could have been if I had access to psychoeducational testing when I was in elementary school. And so my hope and my wish and my dream maybe is that everybody gets access to that kind of testing so that they can find out what their strengths are, find out where their challenges are, and then work with both of those things rather than being forced to fit the same very narrow definition of what normal is supposed to be. That is my big dream for the future, because I found the psychoeducational testing fascinating and I love learning about my own brain. It's really cool.
Thanks for tuning in. You can learn more at our website, seachangecolab.com. That's seachangecolab.com. I hope you join us for our next conversation